Flammable materials warning. Please remain outside the laboratory if you are flammable.
This is the Blackwater Ethercast.
I spotted Professor Wicks almost immediately on boarding the steamship in Dundee. The ship was the RMS Parsons, the same craft in which I now return, and from which I now make my first ethercast from a location outside my library. As you can hear, the more portable etheric transmitter is working splendidly. You may have heard of Professor Hubert Wicks due to his work in the recently discovered inert or noble gases, and his inveterate love of publicity. As so often happens with such a combination, he has effectively increased the public knowledge of chemistry without increasing any public knowledge about it. That is well enough, I suppose, since the average member of the public has little capacity for that understanding, and a near mystical respect for scientists, particularly on the mad scientist end of things, can be useful as a general quality. However, his love of attention is unseemly in a scientist, even one whose occupation is generally that of speaking to an audience. But between one appearance and another, Professor Wicks has managed to produce some interesting devices which make use of these noble gases. My desire to gain a closer look at one in particular was the reason for booking passage on the Parsons. Wicks was about to tour France and Germany to discuss his xenonic spectral recompositor, with a long pause in Belgium for the chocolates which he enjoys even more than a press conference. He would have more than one recompositor with him. Acquiring one would greatly speed my ability to produce the weapon for the cartel. Not only would I gain the knowledge of how it was built, but I would have one at hand to use immediately. Ah yes, the cartel. It seemed strange to me that Mr. DuPont had not given the name of his cartel, not even for the contract, but that Mr. Rue had mentioned it right away. While in Calais, I discovered that the reason the cartel had not given me its name was simply that it hasn't one. For reasons of their own paranoia, they have carefully not named their own organization. I refer to them as the Calais Cartel because I need to refer to them in our discussions, but the phrase is my own. Likewise, the name for them apparently in common use in the French underworld, Les Fourniers. They supply, and are therefore called, the suppliers. It was one less mystery, and not the only one that would be solved during my short trip. The professor turned to me as I approached, with cheerfully raised eyebrows and a jovial, amused smile.
My dear Baron, how pleasant to see you here!
Professor Wicks, I hear you are about to educate the learned public in the practical uses of energized inert gases.
Yes, they may not have heard of xenon before my lecture, but by the end I hope it will no longer be a stranger.
His eyes glinted at his absurdly obscure jest, but I feigned ignorance at the reference. Well, Professor, if anyone can make a case for hot gas, it is surely yourself. Perhaps you would grace us with a demonstration this evening. He narrowed his eyes a bit, but continued.
I do believe I could arrange for something, though without extra equipment, it would be a rather limited demonstration.
My dear Professor, I can promise you my undivided attention for whatever your research has produced, and I am fairly certain that others will find it equally fascinating. He grasped his lapels and puffed his chest a bit.
Well, I am certain I can make a good showing of it for your lordship and our co-passengers. Ah, George, see my luggage to my cabin, would you? And be certain to secure the brass box in the safe I've had installed. The safe should be open when you arrive.
I in turn beckoned to McThomas. Send a porter to deliver my luggage, and once he's on his way, you can be about your business.
Giving your man the day off? How generous, my dear Baron.
He's a simple sort, and deserves his own entertainments now and then. I'm not all bad, you know.
I suppose not. I must take my leave, sir, but will surely see your lordship in the dining room, and the demonstration to follow.
Until then, Professor. Dinner was adequate, the demonstration rather more interesting. Without going too far into the particulars, Wicks' xenonic spectral recompositor uses an electrical discharge to produce light in a xenon-filled ampule,
and a spectrograph to split the light into its component frequencies. That much is simple enough, of course. But the recompositor allows for the frequencies of the energy to be recombined in a variety of ways and, this is the interesting part, in a variety of media. I could describe the possibilities for some time, but for now suffice to say that his research paralleled mine, giving results that would augment my own most usefully. My interest in acquiring a recompositor had been decisively validated and reaffirmed. After the demonstration, I approached Wicks and expressed interest in purchasing one of his devices, immediately if at all possible, and offered a very fair price for it. "My dear Baron, I couldn't possibly do a thing like that." "Why ever not?" "Yes, I have produced a few examples, and do plan to offer them to sale to knowledgeable scientific clientele. But even then, well, sir, you have a certain well-earned reputation, and I would like to be certain that, first, my invention is to be responsibly used. Respectably, if you take my meaning. I haven't enough to vend in any case." "Come, come, we are fellow scientists. Let us be congenial. Unknit your brows and join us tonight for a game of cribbage." I agreed to the game and took my leave with what I am sure was a somewhat resigned look. In the corridor, I came across George, the steward. He tugged his cap brim and stood aside for me to pass, but I stopped and addressed him. "George, isn't it? Excellent work you've been doing here. Good man. I wonder if you could lend me a hand with something unusual. The estimable Professor Wicks and I sustain a good-natured rivalry, as fellow scientists so often do, and I wish to get a leg up on him. No harm will come to any of his research documents, I can assure you, and I shall ask nothing untoward of you. All I wish is that, toward the end of our brief voyage, you let me know when he is out of his cabin for a period of at least several minutes. Perhaps if he has gone early to the dining room, which he sometimes does. Just long enough for me to have a thorough look around. There is a sizable tip that awaits you should I find anything interesting that I can learn from. It could dwarf this pair of shillings which are yours merely for agreeing to keep me apprised. Very good of you to help." The steward's help being secured, and time for cribbage not yet being upon us, I went forward to chat with the captain on the bridge. The outside walkways were pleasantly deserted. Few find enjoyment in a February night's weather on the North Sea. But cold has always felt friendly to me, and though it kept grasping at my hat, the wind seemed companionable. Once the bridge was gained, Captain Hill also proved a satisfying combination of stern and amiable. We discussed selection and operation of an effective crew, and I at once understood how he rose to captaincy of a Royal Mail ship. All too soon it was time to return to the parlor to further my plans by way of cribbage. There were four of us, of course, and Wicks sat opposite me, cheerful as Father Christmas and far more garrulous. A variety of other passengers enjoyed the relaxation of the parlor, some chatting quietly, some waiting to watch the game. We introduced ourselves to our other opponents, one lady and one gentleman, and got to playing. The game went pleasantly, the lady winning by a few points over Wicks. It was a jovial company, and a second game was easily agreed to. Less easy, but none too hard, was the agreement that it should have added interest in the form of a small wager per point. It certainly increased the interest in the onlookers. Still in an easygoing mood, we played and joked and made small talk. The game went well enough for me to begin with, but at a certain point my luck stalled out, as they say. At the end, the professor won handily, and I lagged behind the other two as well. "Don't get down in the mouth, my dear Baron. I'll tell you what. If you win from me as much as you offered for the recompositor, I'll give you that instead. How does that sound? Worth another go or two?" I suggested raising the amount per point as well, which the professor readily agreed to, though the other players balked a bit and stood to watch while another pair eagerly took their places. The battle of cards rejoined with the gratifying mental focus brought by a meaningful wager. The second game went rather more to my favor than the first. I finished somewhat ahead of Wicks, and somewhat behind both the other players, one of whom reached 121 points with remarkable speed. Wicks and I gave each other a congenial ribbing, though I could see in his eyes that he meant to take the next game more seriously. I was the dealer for the third game, which began entirely in my favor. The first two hands scored very highly compared to the other players. After that, my luck turned sour. Even when I drew well, I could not seem to lay my cards in the best order to keep anything like up with Wicks, who apparently could do no wrong by the cards. Despite my dreadful penmanship, I somehow stayed ahead of the other players. At the end, the professor had beaten us all soundly.
"Well, Blackwater, instead of winning the recompositor, you seem to have paid me that much without gaining the device."
"Our friends here have mitigated that somewhat, I see, but it's a bad patch of luck, and no mistake."
"Perhaps you would sell it after all, since I have nearly paid it already."
"Ah, that's not how the game works. One mustn't be greedy, my dear Baron. I need to retire for the evening, but we must play again when your fortune is better."
I bid him a good evening, allowing only faint irritation to color my expression. I had lost the courage game, yes, but no matter. I had positioned my knight and had only to wait for the right move. I thus spent the rest of the evening in the parlor, practicing making small talk, not my natural form of communication. Eventually, I claimed to be tired and returned to my cabin. Continued tinkering with a clockwork device I had brought would absorb my attention until actual weariness overcame me.
Macbeth hears of his wife's death. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the lost syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow. A poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
After breakfast the next morning, George, the steward, arrived at my door with news. The recompositor would be in the safe in Professor Wick's cabin for at least 2 hours before docking, along with the money he had won at cribbage. The research materials would be in the cabin as well. He would let me know when Wicks left his cabin. I thanked the young man and tipped him handsomely, promising still more should I acquire what I needed. He blinked and looked down slightly at that, but thanked me and tugged his hat brim before departing. As promised, about 2 hours before we entered the Calais harbor, George returned and simply said, "He's gone to the dining room." I donned my greatcoat and quickly left to fetch the recompositor. Leaving went quickly enough. Arriving at the professor's cabin was a much slower process. Partway there, my path was suddenly blocked by a trolley full of kitchen equipment rolling into the corridor and spilling its contents. The porters who had let it slip arrived a moment later, full of apologies and fuss, making entirely too much of being sure I was unhurt, and bustling about restacking their precarious cargo on the trolley. It was, in fact, several minutes before they had cleared the way, and a few more before they had ceased their endless apologies for the trouble that their apologies were continuing. Passing through the parlor to the other side of the ship, some of the onlookers from the previous evening's game stopped me to inquire about the twists of fate which seemed to bedevil my play. It was impossible to put them off without violating even my unconventional notions of politeness. They wanted to go step by step through the last game in particular, seemingly incredulous that my luck and my ability should have deserted me so thoroughly. I agreed, of course, that it was unprecedented in my experience, and could only tell them that sometimes when one small mistake has been made, it grows in the mind and flusters the feathers, so to speak, causing larger mistakes to follow in the wake of the smaller. Each time I was certain I had answered their concerns and curiosity, and was about to be cleanly on my way, someone would say, "But what about?" And we'd be off onto another bout of doubtful recollection and more doubtful explanation. It would be difficult to convey the agony of an unending, uninteresting, and entirely unnecessary question and answer session, which seemed only to exist to delay my progress. However, at long last, I pried myself free of their conversational clutches and escaped to the far corridor. At that point, it was largely a matter of waiting for the other passengers to leave the hallway empty for a few moments so that I could slip into the professor's cabin. At last, they obliged. Steward George was as good as his word, and the cabin was deserted. It was the work of a moment to locate the safe. Another moment, and I had brought out the device I had been adjusting the previous evening. On activation, six spider-like legs unfolded from the palm-sized central disc to grasp the edges of the safe door. A flat-fronted listening device extended to rest against the door, and a pair of wheels, lined with India rubber, pressed themselves to opposite sides of the dial. The wheels whirled into action, spinning the dial, then abruptly stopping before slowly turning it back and forth. Less than 1 minute later, the latch clicked, and the device began to retract its various parts. I tucked it into my coat pocket again, quite satisfied at its maiden usage. I flicked the door open with a finger to retrieve the brass box within. However, there was no brass box within. In fact, there was nothing at all. The many delays had kept me away for long enough that Wicks or one of his people had already returned to get it. The time was probably drawing near to leave the ship. Calais was almost certainly in sight at this point. I needed to find out where the box had got to. After closing the safe and checking that the corridor was still empty, I left the cabin and searched for the professor at a quick walk. Before I saw him, I saw his assistant, brass box in hand. It was held shut with nothing more than a pair of flip latches. If I could isolate it for even 5 or 10 seconds, I could open, empty, and close it. Getting to it for that long was the key. I needed some coordinated distractions. I hailed the professor. He turned with his customary good cheer. "Hello, my dear Baron. Have you had a pleasant trip?" "My dear Professor, it has been very informative and, in spite of its, costs, quite educational. I must thank you for that, I dare say." "Very generous of you, I dare say," Wicks said with a glint in his eye. "But you never did tell me what your interest actually was regarding my little recompositor." "Good of you to ask, Professor. I happen to have some initial sketches with me right now." I turned to his assistant. "Would you be so good as to hold us for a moment?" Without waiting for a reply, I handed him my greatcoat, causing him to release the brass box to retain the coat's spreading bulk. I drew a roll of papers from the outside pocket and unfurled them with a flourish. "Behold, the beginnings of a light-based communication network." Wicks raised his eyebrows and examined the drawings with interest. He looked about for a table to set them on. "I believe that it is a small seating area just ahead, if you would like to get some better light on the subject." "Quite so. Come along, Winston." Though I moved to pick up the brass box, the assistant somehow hooked a couple of fingers into its handle and brought it along. I made not the faintest motion toward retrieving my greatcoat from him. We shortly arrived at what was essentially a nook with some benches and a small table, and Wicks set to deciphering my hastily made sketches. He glanced at his assistant. "Hang that coat, won't you, Winston? You look absurd." The assistant gave me as much of a disapproving look as he dared, but set the box down behind Wicks and went to a nearby hat stand to deposit my coat. By the time he had turned to rejoin us, I had emptied the brass box and silently latched it again. It contained not a device of any kind, but a letter-sized envelope and what felt like a masonry brick. There was no time to do anything but slip the letter into my breast pocket before Winston, the assistant, was back at the professor's side. Wicks nodded. "Most intriguing, my dear Baron. You must visit me sometime, and we can discuss the many possibilities raised by your ideas."
"You are entirely too kind, Professor."
"Nothing of the sort," he said, and his eyes glittered with jolly mischief. "I believe in taking into account the measure of the minds with which I interact. And you, Blackwater, have provided much thought and marvelous diversion."
"One does what one can."
"Indeed one does, sir. If you'll pardon me, I must prepare to disembark with my staff."
I bowed slightly in acknowledgement, retrieved my greatcoat, and returned to my own cabin to see that my effects were properly transported. Once there, I opened the envelope from the box and removed the letter within. It said, "Sorry, old bean." With great effort, I resisted the urge to crumple the paper and throw it overboard. Instead, I folded it carefully, returned it to its envelope, and put it with the books and papers waiting to be taken ashore. Once the porters had bundled off my luggage, it was time for me to leave the ship as well. I came across Professor Wicks again, staff in tow, as he approached the passenger gangway from a different direction. He greeted me with a cheerful wave.
"Well, it's farewell and bon voyage for now, my dear Blackwater. I trust that each of our itineraries will be both profitable and enjoyable."
"It would have speeded my profitability if you had been willing to part with a recompositor."
Now, mustn't be greedy. Better luck next time. Though I do feel somewhat responsible for impeding your progress, these things take time."
His eyes twinkled again, but I pretended to be unaware of any underlying meaning. Behind him, Winston maintained his placid look, but George managed to simultaneously convey both embarrassment and self-satisfaction. I merely touched my hat and said,
"Then until next time, Professor, bon voyage."
Shortly after Wicks and his staff had boarded their coach and left the docks, my own coach arrived. As the porters loaded the luggage, McThomas appeared from the cargo loading area with a brass box in each hand.
"Well, sir, that was much easier with them all chasing you around. Do you ken, he had 4 dozen of these tucked in the hold." I thought to myself, if my lord can use one, my lord can use 2.
"Excellent thinking, McThomas.
Should I have got another?"
No, mustn't be greedy." He looked slightly surprised at that statement, but nodded and put the boxes in with the rest of the luggage. We arrived fairly soon at the cartel's compound. To a trained eye, it was a well-fortified place, though I imagine it would generally appear as a formidable and unappealing industrial zone. It sat beside the water and featured its own dock, as influential import and export companies tend to do. The central building was several stories high and sat on a small hillock, and thus was visible from the outside. Its architecture bespoke a severe and businesslike opulence. Our coach stopped at the guarded gate before proceeding into the compound. A couple minutes later, we disembarked at the entrance to the headquarters. From that vantage point, the entire complex could be seen, though little of the city outside. There were some workshops, but most of the area was taken by warehouses and barracks. The warehouses I expected, but the number of barracks seemed entirely outsized for a profit-minded criminal organization. It would be able to house a small army. And if it had that kind of manpower, what did it mean my weapon for? Merely for show? Perhaps they wanted to avoid revealing their numbers, even to their avowed enemies. It was certainly a curious question. André Dupont came out and greeted us effusively, then led the way into the building. We took a lift to the 3rd floor and entered a large, sparsely furnished room that nevertheless gave the impression of power. It was the office of the cartel's leader, René Blanc, who turned from the window to welcome me to his headquarters. He was a man of not exactly military bearing, but with an air of comfortability in his control over things. We quickly got to discussing what I had in mind for his defensive weapon. It was to be something handled much like a ship's swivel cannon, but rather larger. It would be mounted on a pylon for ease of use and connected through it to a power source. Its wielder would stand behind it and aim at the target. One hand would identify the range, and the other would give fire when ready, releasing a stream of essentially electrical energy. A xenonic spectral recompositor would provide the correct wavelength to keep the stream coherent for the range. Otherwise, it would provide merely a moderate electric shock to anyone within a few feet of the beam. Startling, but hardly a weapon. Properly focused into a beam, however, it would deliver enormous energy to whatever was unfortunate enough to block its path. Mr. Blanc seemed moderately impressed by the planned weapon, which Mr. DuPont later explained to me was his version of exuberant enthusiasm.
I have never seen him so excited.
One takes what one can get, I suppose. We had stepped out onto the external area of the building, a sort of patio over the roof of the second floor, the space where the weapon would be mounted. As I pointed out the field of fire available to the position, a horn blast from the docking ship caught Mr. Blanc's attention. He beckoned me to the end of the patio where the dock was visible past the hill and buildings.
The assets have arrived, soon to be delivered to where they are needed. This is what your weapon will defend.
I see, I said. And I did. Watching the unloading and sorting, all the little mysteries came clear, and indeed I did understand how their distribution system worked. I would definitely need to produce a specialized weapon for them. We finalized all necessary agreements for delivery, and I collected all of the fee except for the final 20% due on delivery. Without further ado, we returned to the port. There was no need to remain in Calais overnight, and the RMS Parsons would be prepared to return to Dundee in mere hours. As the porters began to return the luggage to my cabin, I heard,
"Baron! Baron!"
from just down the road. It was Jacques Roux, whom I had nearly forgotten about in the complications of the day. We found a quiet location to conduct our business at a mostly empty café. I asked him, "What precisely is the desired effect for your attack? Impressive annihilation? Wipe out their defenses and docks? Subtle destruction of their headquarters, perhaps?"
"Pardon, Baron, but we do not wish to destroy their buildings at all. We merely wish to take it over."
"Ah, you want their business for yourself. I understand." I thought silently for a moment as Mr. Roux looked on apprehensively. Finally, I said, "I believe I can supply you with just the weapon for the purpose. There is a design I have been working on, and if you can pay half of my fee within the week, I should be able to produce the weapon in just under a month. My agent will take the rest of the payment at the time of delivery, of course. It is to be an energy weapon of the very latest technology, with excellent precision and spectacular results." Mr. Roux was ecstatic at the news, and promised to arrange for the transfer of funds for the very next morning. I returned to the ship, quite satisfied with my plans. After all, I have two of the recompositors now. Surely I can use the second for a portable version of the weapon. As soon as we return to Blackwater Castle, I shall begin work on them both. To be a belligerent in a war is a messy, risky thing. Often both parties are damaged in the conflict to little or no benefit to either. Unless one is objectively certain of success, I do not recommend it. To supply the means for the contest, however, can, with minimal exposure, prove both profitable and interesting. Wouldn't you agree?
The Blackwater Aethercast is written, produced, and performed by Nicholas Jovian. Additional voices by Kayla Thomas. The beginning and ending music is by Derek and Brandon Fichter. They can be found at dbfichter.bandcamp.com. Today's entertainment was from Macbeth by William Shakespeare. Be sure to subscribe to the Aethercast and send your friends to lordblackwire.com so they can too. A new chapter is released twice monthly. Also, visit lordblackwire.com to be the featured entertainment. And thanks for listening. You're awesome.